Hello, everybody. Welcome in to the Lakers Collective. We've got a lot to talk about on today's show. We're going to try to really lean into what the Lakers need to do this summer in order for their offseason to be successful. What are the big keys for LA to accomplish this summer? Plus, we'll talk a little bit about the NBA Finals. And of course, those of you joining us live will take your questions, your comments. If you haven't done so yet, please hit the subscribe button. If you already subscribed, hit the like button. Like this video. Get it out there. I'm Trevor Lane. He's Jovan Buha. Jovan, we got a pretty good finals game last night. Let's start there. 29-point comeback for the Knicks. Good Lord, the largest in NBA Finals history. That was so much fun. Heartbreaking, obviously, if you're a Spurs fan, but basketball is awesome. I was just grinning that entire fourth quarter because of the drama behind that game.
Incredible game last night. I decided to go live after the game. I'd had a bunch of friends over to watch it. I had a beer. I was like, I'm just going to enjoy myself tonight and enjoy this basketball game. And then after that, I was like, there's no way I can't go live after this. So, no, just so many big moments and so many things that get lost within. Like, if the Knicks lose that game, that Josh Hart missed transition dunk / layup goes down as one of the biggest blunders in NBA Finals history. Instead, it flips the other way, and you have one of the biggest shots in Finals history and arguably the biggest shot in Knicks history with the OG tip-in. And then it becomes, why did Fox take that play in transition? And Wemby missing the two free throws, and Mitch Johnson not calling a timeout during a 20-4 run. So, like, it felt like that final few minutes was the championship. Had the Spurs held on, yes, like the Knicks would have regained some momentum, but Spurs would have won two in a row. They would have had two of the final three potential games in San Antonio. Instead, New York goes up 3-1, and now they're in the driver's seat to win the championship. So, it just felt like this sliding doors moment in NBA history that we were witnessing, and it was mistake after mistake, but also big play after big play, and it was just an awesome finish.
Yeah, I mean, Josh Hart also blew that box out on Steph Castle that led to a couple of free throws. The Castle knocked down Wemby, missing a couple of free throws. Like, there were some big moments there where this in the finals, I didn't think so much in the West Finals, but in the NBA Finals, there have been a number of moments, including that Wemby turnover that we saw in game two, where it felt like the Spurs were just maybe not quite ready for these big high pressure moments. And unfortunately, the guy they brought in to be the guy to bring the veteran experience, and that's De'Aaron Fox, made perhaps the biggest mistake of the game, trying to challenge OG Anunoby, who was the hero of the day, over 30 points, shot the hell out of the ball from three, made the big tip in there, almost at the buzzer to win the game for the Knicks. A phenomenal play there. That was even where just a small little thing, they decided not to guard the inbounder on the play, and that was OG Anunoby, and then that led to OG being unmarked on his crash to the rim. It all just ultimately collapsed against the Spurs, one thing after another after another. And like you said, mistakes made on both sides, but the Knicks were ultimately the team that was able to come away with the win. And winds up being, like you said, it wound up being what would have been a game Josh Hart would have never forgotten and would have never lived down in an extremely negative way. It would have been one of those things that would have stuck with him for the rest of his life to this incredible celebration for Knicks fans, and instead maybe something De'Aaron Fox will have a hard time living down. So, I mean, happy for our guy Josh Hart, former Laker Josh Hart, that now he doesn't have to spend the rest of his life thinking about, man, if I had made that layup, what could have happened? But now the Knicks set to potentially win the NBA championship here in game five. Do you think we get past game five, or did that just take everything out of the Spurs? What happened last game?
I think the Spurs have won five. And look, like, they've had a double-digit lead in the first quarter in all four games. Like, the Spurs have gotten off to these great starts, and they just have not been able to maintain the lead. I think they prevail and push it to game six, and then they lose in six in at MSG, and then New York gets to celebrate appropriately at home. But yeah, I mean, De'Aaron Fox, to me, like, I think there's a lot of blame to go around. Like, Wemby had a terrible second half. You saw the before and after with the Mitch Robinson situation, where after he told Mitch Robinson he's in his head and picked up the technical foul, he goes 4-for-18 from that point on. Missed the two free throws. Wemby just was not great enough down the stretch of that game. But Mitch Johnson with a 20-4 run, like I he's been very slow with the timeouts in this series, and even at times in the OKC series where the game was slipping away from them very clearly, and they had already blown a 30-point lead or 29-point lead down into the mid-teens. And New York was going on this extended run, and he just did not call a timeout until it was a 4-point game. And at that point, the damage was already done. But De'Aaron Fox, that final stretch there of you get the tip ahead, which you can only take that shot if you are like wide open. And he completely miscalculated. He said he thought he could beat OG Anunoby to the rim, which he did. And then there's now been this Zapruder film of he got fouled, but it's just such a bang bang sequence. You're not going to get that call in that moment. Yeah, so there's a still of OG Anunoby actually smacks. I think he gets like he swipes down and gets part of the ball, but then he ends up smacking De'Aaron Fox's arm. So it should have been a foul, but it just you're not going to get that call in that moment. So you have that. Then they did have a foul to give, but they had five Spurs defenders in the backcourt. And three Knicks players were in the front court. Two Knicks players were still in the backcourt. And then he goes for the foul there where it's like there's no advantage for the Knicks. You didn't need to foul. Like, just let the Knicks try to figure it. They end up calling the timeout. But, like, let the Knicks try to figure it out. Don't just go foul them and bail them out when they're not set offensively. Then he randomly doubles against Brunson when Brunson's got Wemby on him. Like, let Brunson hit that shot over Wemby. You don't need a double there. And then just turns, watches, doesn't go crash, doesn't go put a body on OG Anunoby, his man. And that leads to the biggest play. So it was like mistake after mistake after mistake for De'Aaron Fox, to say nothing of like that third quarter, three unforced turnovers, a couple just passes out of bounds, is settling for step backs. Like, I just thought he, like, Wemby's going to get a bunch of heat, deservedly so. Mitch Johnson, deservedly so. And Fox has been getting it too. I just think that was like an absolute disaster class in the second half where he just was not. And even I think the layup attempt was honestly on some level him not wanting to get fouled and going to the free throw line and having to hit like two big free throws. Mm-hmm. So, I thought it was a really rough second half for him.
I hadn't thought of that maybe he didn't want to go to the line. Wound up being, I mean, you don't challenge OG Anunoby. He is phenomenal. What a great game from him. But that was a big mistake there. And did you see the final play? I didn't catch it live, but that ball was tipped. Cat got a Kat, fingertip.
Great tip
to that.
By Cat.
Otherwise,
I actually thought it was a solid play. If he didn't tip that,
the Spurs win.
Stephon, yeah. And we're talking about an even better play to win the game in terms of just like, you know, Castle matching OG's bucket. But I mean, what a tip in from OG, by the way, because in the moment it looked like you kind of, it's just a bang bang sequence. You see it happen and it's impressive, but you don't get to see it actually like rewatching it. And he was so far, like so many things had, it was the perfect miss. It was the perfect trajectory for him. He timed it right. He out jumps Vassell and Harper and tips that in. And it was just, it was a miracle play. And the Knicks feel like a team of destiny.
If you were a Knicks fan that spent the thousands upon thousands upon thousands of dollars that you had to spend to get into that game, there was a point where maybe at halftime you're thinking, oh my God, I just spent all that money to see my team get their asses kicked, to see my team just get blown off the floor. And as it turned out, if they stuck in there, I'm sure there's some Knicks fans who maybe shut the game off early, who left or whatever. But if you stayed with it, man, you got to see the greatest comeback in NBA Finals history. I was happy for those Knicks fans. Not so happy for the Knicks fans that were like throwing things at Wemby after the game. If you saw that,
no.
He was trying to get into his hotel and they're throwing stuff at him and everything. Like, let's be better than that. But I was happy for the Knicks fans that were there in the building. They got to experience something like that.
I also would say I'm not sure, like they've had this, the Fox thing is its own podcast where we could go into like what they should do with Fox moving forward, because I think for most of the postseason, I think Stephon Castle's clearly been better than him. I think Harper, it's been more of a game by game basis, but overall, definitely in the finals, Harper has been better than him. But I would even argue that like on that final defensive possession, they should not, like, that was not the time to go with the four guard lineup. That was like Julian Champagne should have been in there, or maybe you put Luke Kornet as like you're going to just park Luke Kornet at the rim and have Wemby be roaming or whatever. Like you had to do something different there than going with the smalls. Cause I would argue if you were going to take out one of those guys, Fox was the guy to take out. And then he does make the defensive mistake of both doubling and then not boxing out. So I just felt like that was also its own mistake that like, I don't think Fox should have been out there to begin with in that final defensive play. I think it should have been at least Champagne, who's a much better defender than him and also a better rebounder and like, you know, hustle crash guy, or it, you could have gone like Kornet and just gone like double big. One of them's going to protect the rim. Wemby can roam to whoever. And then you're sort of in scramble mode, but yeah, it was a big mistake on their part. Cause that's been one of their issues is when they go to that smaller lineup, they give up a ton of offensive rebounds. Yep. And that's exactly what happened in that sequence.
Well, and on top of that, that you mentioned it, but that foul to give situation, just because you have a foul to give doesn't mean you should do it with what, about 5 seconds and change left mm-hmm. in the game. And the ball is in the hands of Jose Alvarado. It's different. If it's in Jalen Brunson's hands and he's just making his step towards the basket, that's a little different than the ball's in Jose Alvarado's hands and he's scrambling around at half court. Just because you can give a foul doesn't mean you should. I thought that was a bonehead play as well. There was no reason to, in that moment, commit the foul. You could have at least run off a couple more seconds. Then if they get the ball to Brunson, go ahead and commit the foul and make them inbound again. But there was no advantage to be gained by the Spurs in that moment. I thought it was just a lot of inexperience shining through. And to me, before we move on here to Lakers, the big thing that I took away from this game and this series really has been that while De'Aaron Fox was brought in to be the veteran presence on this team, not all veteran experience is equal. It's different when you're getting a guy who's come from Sacramento who doesn't have experience in these big high-pressure playoff moments. Yes, he's older. Yes, he's played in the NBA more years, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's quality experience. And I think that was one of the problems that we've seen throughout the finals here, is that while De'Aaron Fox has experience, it's not the kind of experience that's going to take you to that next level in the NBA Finals. I think the Spurs have a De'Aaron Fox problem. And part of it is Dylan Harper's been so good. I would have trusted Dylan Harper more in that moment where Fox took the layup. Had Dylan Harper had the ball there, I think he probably would have made the right play. That's a testament to how mature Dylan Harper's game really is at this point. But it's also, I think, potentially a big problem given that contract that De'Aaron Fox has. So I'm really curious to see how the Spurs ultimately handle that situation, because it's pretty clear Castle and Harper, the future is now. They're ready to be the guys now. You don't need De'Aaron Fox, but you paid him so much. I don't know that you can move him. That's going to be, I think, interesting to see how the Spurs handle that situation.
Yeah, they remind me of the Rockets in a way, in terms of he was supposed to be the Fred VanVleet to this situation in San Antonio, in terms of like bridging them between eras, right? Like on paper, this Spurs situation has been ahead of schedule by at least a year or two. Most people had them, I think Vegas had them projected as a play-in team going into the season. No one had them as a 2 seed. No one had them winning 62 plus games, making the NBA finals, beating the Thunder in the Western Conference finals. So they've been ahead of schedule to a degree. And that's what's put them in this tough position where it was supposed to be, I think, Fox as this placeholder for 2 or 3 years as this group matured, hit their mid-20s, and then they can move on into the next era. But the next era is now. And Harper and Castle, I think, are just straight up outplaying him now, and at times have looked calmer under pressure, have looked more like the veteran. Like if you just took away the names, took away the experience, and was just like, which guys look more under control, have better composure, a better poise, I think it's often been Castle and Harper, especially Harper. Like Harper plays like he's a 10-year veteran. Castle has some wild card energy to him, but he's also one of the best perimeter defenders in the league and also one of the few guys who's consistently getting downhill for them. So, yeah, I mean, that's a tough contract to move. I don't know what team is going to be clamoring to be paying De'Aaron Fox 50, whatever million he's making, but yeah, they have to figure that out. Like I said this last night on my show, like Lauri Markkanen to me would be a perfect fit in San Antonio. And I don't think Utah would do that trade. But if there was if you're just talking what's in San Antonio's best interest, some sort of swap where if you had a lineup of Harper and Castle and Vassell and a 4 plus Wemby, like an elite 4, I think that is the best version of, I mean, it could be an Aaron Gordon, a Lauri Markkanen, you know, two totally different positional archetypes, but some sort of stud for replacing Fox and then you inserting Harper as a starter. I think that's the long-term vision in San Antonio.
Here's the sobering thought for Lakers fans. the fallback from a Markkanen would be Rui. Like, Rui Hachimura with their mid-level would be excellent in San Antonio if they were to go that route. Not that Rui's on the same level as Markkanen, but in terms of, like, the floor spacing that you'd be getting from a Markkanen, Rui Hachimura.
And they have the defenders to protect him.
Exactly.
So, yeah. Exactly. I think that'd be a great fit.
Okay, let's pivot over to Lakers stuff here. We want to talk about what it is that the Lakers need to accomplish this summer. How are we going to walk out of this summer feeling like the Lakers have taken significant steps forward, and what are the keys to doing so? I've been saying repeatedly that if the goal for the Lakers, in the minds of Lakers fans, if it is we need to have on paper a better roster than OKC or San Antonio, that's just not happening. You're not going to have that kind of a roster on paper coming out of the summer. So understanding that that's not where the bar can be set, but the bar does have to still exist. And it can't simply be set at, well, running it back is success. Obviously, change needs to be made. So let's get into what specifically we need to see happen from this Lakers team. Yovan, I think you've been talking about a little bit, especially on our last show, you want to see them get active on the trade front. Is that a key to the summer for you, that they have to make a trade this summer and break what has now been a streak of how many consecutive years is it that they haven't made a trade?
It's been three straight off seasons with no trade. So the last off season trade they made, and I'm not counting like buying a second round pick or mm-hmm. or doing a draft day swap of some sort of draft capital, but the actual, like, last time they made a legitimate trade to improve the roster. And really, I mean, they haven't even done any cost-cutting trades. So, like, the last time the Lakers made an actual, like, player-specific non-draft-related trade was August 2022 with acquiring Patrick Beverley. And so 2023, 2024, 2025, they sat out those off-seasons, did not make any trades. Every move they made was free agent-related. And then they made some moves. I mean, one of the biggest moves of all time, to their credit, with the Luka Doncic trade in-season. But the Lakers have tended to sit out off seasons. They have felt the prices have been too high to get off. And, like, there's something to that. But my counter to that has repeatedly been the downside to waiting. Like, yes, you might get a lower price, but the downside is it disrupts your continuity. And we've seen this time and time again with the Lakers, where they make these midseason trades and sometimes it even gels quickly. But they eventually run into a situation where they don't have the reps together. They don't have the continuity, the know-how together. And then we hear it at the exit interview. It's an annual tradition of, like, we just didn't have enough time together with this group. Like, we made this midseason trade. We want to see what this looks like going into next season. That has been a repeated talking point each of the last few seasons. And my point is, like, well, then build the roster in the summer, go into training camp with the roster you want. Then if you have a hole, if you have an injury, if something's not working, then you make the move. But the Lakers keep going into the season with these incomplete rosters that are clearly not going to be the roster going into the playoffs. And then they're like, well, let's rebuild or you know, compose the roster during the season. And I just think that is a flawed logic. And you see with even, like, the teams that all made the conference finals, none of them really made big trades during the season. Cleveland did the Schroeder Keon Ellis trade, but, like, for the most part, you're going with your top seven or eight guys that you had to start the season. So I just think, you know, OKC added McCain, but that was like an embarrassment of riches situation. So for the Lakers, I would say my big thing is they cannot run it back. I think so that to me is like operating above the cap. Like, if you're operating above the cap and even just doing some sort of move where you're running it back with the primary rotation and you're like, hey, can we dump Vando and DK for something? I think that's a mistake. I don't think that's enough of a change. So I would say I'm completely anti running it back. And I would like to see some sort of trade this offseason, even if it's a minor move, some sort of trade of, like, actually showing you're willing to invest in the group in the summer and not just during the season. And the last thing would be actually trading some draft capital. And I don't think you should just trade draft capital willy-nilly, but I also think, like, you keep talking about keeping your picks for the future. You want to do something in the future. Well, like, the future is now. And go actually go, like, you have the cap space, go trade for someone. Go trade for a starter. Go plug a hole in your roster. So my three things in general would be I think they need to make some real changes to the rotation. I don't think this is a situation where you just run it back. I think they need to make a trade of some sort. And I think they should be in investing draft capital in the roster in terms of upgrading it. And if they do those three things in like a more general sense, that to me would be a massive step in the right direction this summer.
Yeah, I'm in agreement with everything you said. I do see a path where I know we look at staying above the cap as running it back. If you're going to effectively do that and run it back, and that means you're going to have to bring back all your guys, right? If you stay above the cap, you're not going to have the spending power to go get somebody to replace Rui Hachimura if he leaves or replace Luke Kennard or Marcus Smart, any of those guys. So it would be imperative that you bring back your guys. But if you could facilitate a big multiplayer trade, that would be the one caveat where you could say, well, if they do this, though, like that's where they could perhaps make significant changes to their roster. You really have to lean heavily into that trade piece if you do operate as an above the cap team. And in that world, that's where we can say, you know, we've had the conversation quite a bit about Austin Reeves, what his contract is in this first year doesn't matter because they're going to use his cap hold anyway. That would not be true in a scenario where they are an above the cap team. Then we're just talking about trying to stay under that first apron, which is going to be, off the top of my head, I think it's $209 million is going to be the first apron. 209. So that's where you're trying to stay below. But again, you'd have to facilitate some type of big, significant trade. Because I agree, you can't just run back this same team. On the one hand, you can look at it and say, well, we were the four seed. You know, we were without Luka. Luka was hurt. If Luka had been healthy, obviously things looked very different in the playoffs. Austin was just coming off of an injury. Maybe we're actually the team that we were in March. I think that would be a mistake. If they just say it was injuries, and all we need to do is be healthy next year and we'll be fine. No, I think there's some serious flaws with this roster. We knew that there were flaws with the roster last summer. And the conversation was, well, they kept the powder dry for the trade deadline and they'd be able to fix those things then. Obviously, that did not come to fruition, didn't wind up happening. So I do think that having a roster together this summer is going to be imperative. Go into the season with the pieces that you want. And my point that I wanted to get to here of what I'd like to see from the Lakers is I want to see a semblance of an identity. And that may not be apparent until we actually get into the season exactly what that identity is. But I think of like the Phoenix Suns, right? And the Phoenix Suns had a better season than we would have expected from them. They weren't a great team, but they were dangerous. Obviously, they beat the Lakers a number of times this year. But nonetheless, they're a dangerous team. But the bigger thing is Jordan Ott was able to figure out what the identity of this club is. What is it that is going to set this team apart? And I don't think the Lakers have quite figured that out. And some of that may be that they're kind of caught between two worlds right now where they were a LeBron team, but oh wait, now surprise, we've got Luka and we're trying to pivot to become a Luka team. I think they have a sense, based on Rob Pelinka's comments, based on JJ Redick's comments, of what that identity needs to be in terms of having the right kind of depth, the right kind of athleticism, stylistically, hopefully the right type of players, no more small guards that can't defend, that type of thing. But we need to see them execute that. I want to see what is Rob Pelinka's actual vision for the team. I recall a show that we did a while back, Jovan, where you joked, I think it was half joking anyway, when I mentioned the need for an identity with the team and what is Rob Pelinka's plans, what is his ideal team? And you threw in a comment about, well, maybe it is going after small combo guards. Maybe that is what he envisions for the team. I want to see proof that that vision has shifted. And now there is a real understanding of what types of pieces need to be plugged in. The puzzle pieces don't all have to be perfect fits in a vacuum, but I want to have a sense of, oh, they went and got this guy. This guy has a weakness here, but now they got somebody else and he's able to mitigate some of those weaknesses. And I want to get a feel for how all these puzzle pieces come together, because I don't think there's been a great sense that they have really assembled pieces in a logical way heading up until now. And that to me really has to change.
So I took the macro point of view with my answer to your question, but if we want to start digging into the micro, the Lakers have not added a long-term piece around Luka Doncic since they have acquired him. The closest thing to that might be Adu Thiro, but there are some open-ended questions with him, just with his health and how his offensive game is going to develop. Like, I think he will eventually turn into at least a rotation player, but at best, we're talking about like right now, a guy who projects to be like a back end rotation guy with the current version of the Lakers over the next couple of years. So like they've added that. Otherwise, none of the pieces they've added, I mean, they did the Mark Williams trade, they end up rescinding it, but like everything they've added since then has been short-term solutions. They've been putting band-aids on the situation. They need to add some long-term pieces. So I think the two objectives, like operating under the assumption that they're trying to do the three things that I talked about and that we're in agreement with, mm-hmm. it then needs to be, okay, you need a new starting center, you need a new two-way wing that slots Marcus more in an Alex Caruso type bench role off of, you know, in just, I think, a more proper slotting, sustainable slotting for him. And ideally, both of those guys are long-term pieces. So that's where my preference, which I stated last show, is actually go hard in restricted free agency, like do your due diligence, see what those numbers are projected to be in terms of what is Utah going to pay Kessler? What is Detroit going to pay Durin? What is Houston going to pay Eason? What is Denver going to pay Watson? See if you are comfortable and can stomach paying them $2 to $3 million more to try to poach them and make those teams sweat that out. If you can't do that, then I think you turn to the trade market. If you are unable to find a starter there or potentially a situation where you could take on a contract, get some assets, then you turn to unrestricted free agency. Because I think even with unrestricted free agency, like some of the names people are throwing out, Quentin Grimes, Kelly Oubre, Mitchell Robinson, Robert Williams, like I just don't know that these guys move the needle enough. And like Grimes could be a long-term piece, but everyone else there I think is more of a short-term solution as well. So it's like, and I don't want to bet on Robert Williams or Mitchell Robinson being the starting center and trying to stay healthy for even 60 games. Like that's been a pretty bad bet throughout their careers up to this point. So it's like, then you're going center by committee, but you've also invested a certain amount of money in the center spot. And it's just, I think the Lakers' best bet to me is like try to get a restricted free agent or make a trade. And if you can't do either one of those things, my last resort would be unrestricted free agency, because I just don't really love the unrestricted market.
Yeah, agreed. Like if you walk out of unrestricted free agent, I don't know. I've had some fans throw at me like, hey, Norman Powell. Yeah, if you walk out of unrestricted free agency with Norman Powell, that's not fitting what the identity
is. He's also not good enough defensively to play with Luka and Austin long term.
That would be a, hey, we got somebody, we got something. And that's my fear, is that if they're overly reliant, I think they've got to lean heavily into the trade market this summer. If they're overly reliant on, hey, we've got $48 million plus minus whatever, you know, depending on what DeAndre Ayton does, what Marcus Smart does and so on, right? In cap space, we've got all this cap space to spend. We're going to be reliant upon free agency. Look, there's a reason why nobody else has free agent money to spend. There's a reason why. And it's because there's nobody to spend it on. If there were, guess what? More teams would have money in free agency. More teams would be banking on this summer having that kind of flexibility. But Chicago, Brooklyn, and the Lakers, the only teams that have significant spending power. And it's not because everybody else in the NBA is stupid. It's because everybody else in the NBA sees that there's just not that much out there. Now, that doesn't mean that there won't be opportunity to maybe capitalize on some bargains and things like that. It doesn't mean that there's nobody out there that can help. But to your point, in terms of actually finding guys that are going to move the needle, that are going to be significant long-term additions, rather than, hey, this is a guy that we're just getting for right now. Look, to say we did something, you're probably going to have to do that on the trade front. And I also want to throw this in. You know, the more I look at this situation, the more I look at the spot that the Lakers are in right now, you've got Luka Doncic. What is he, 27 years old? He played like the best player in the world the last time we saw him for a month, right? Then he gets hurt. The first game of April, he gets hurt. But the last we saw of Luka, like really be Luka, was he's the best player in the world. And maybe he's not quite that right. You can argue, oh no, he's the third, he's the, whatever. One of the best players on the planet. Trade the pick. The 25th pick, if we've learned anything from the draft in the last couple of years, it's that there is no certainty. And there are a lot of players that I like that we're projecting to be there at 25. But when you've got Luka on your team right now, ready to win, I'll take a guy who I know is maybe 80% of what I think maybe the guy I get at 25 could ultimately become. I'll take the certainty right now if that's out there. Now, of course, the context is what is out there? What can you trade 25 for? Are you trading it for somebody that can actually help you out, or are you just trading it to trade it? Of course, you've got to strike a good deal. But to me, you've gambled twice on the draft, It has not worked out. You've lost the ability to gamble again because you cannot miss a third time. You need a known quantity. And I know we talk about how important it is to get players on rookie cost control contracts and all of that, but I think the misses in the draft the last 2 years have now taken away the ability to miss again. I don't think you can roll the dice. I think you need a known quantity. And so that can involves to me turning the 25th pick into something that you know is going to help this team rather than a player that you think might, if they are able to make the transition to the NBA level, maybe help you out.
I cannot agree with you more. And to the point on Luka being 27, like most of the best players of all time, if you look at their peak years, it is that 27 to 29 range, like the all-time. I mean, that's just typically the prime of a player. And some guy like LeBron is rewritten what a prime looks like, right? But for the most part, you look at like the peak statistical best years of a player's career, it's typically that 27 to 29 range for the best players of all time. And again, like Luka's peak could be 30 to 32. Like I'm not going to project out what Luka's peak is going to look like, but Luka is entering his peak right now if he's not there already. And that means you should be going for it right now. And so to your point, like if LA is drafting for, or you know, acquiring, you know, taking these gambles on guys that are young, and it's sort of like, well, let's have this bridge year again or this gap year, and we'll still be really good, but like maybe not at the top of the league, but we'll next year we'll make this move, or the year after or whatever. It's like, no, it's got to be now. Like I think they need to do everything they can this summer to build a championship level roster going into the season. And again, if there's injuries, if things aren't working, if there's a hole in the rotation, then you plug that at the deadline with your remaining pieces, your remaining assets. But I think doing the sort of haphazard patchwork that they've done over the last few summers, to me, would be a giant mistake.
Let me ask you this, because there's been a lot of conversation about, you know, LeBron. What happens with LeBron James? We're talking about building a roster, having an identity, building this team out properly around Luka. Is building a team around Luka and bringing back LeBron James, are those two things mutually exclusive, or can those two things happen simultaneously?
I think those two things can happen simultaneously, but it is a delicate dance. Like I was talking about this last night on my show. I got asked a question, and it was more so through the lens of, is it possible to make Luka and LeBron work together defensively? And I really like that question, because I think a lot of times people focus on the offense, and it's the, well, there's one basketball and what's the hierarchy and who's the number one, who's the number two, who's the number three. But I think it's more so like the big three, I thought, figured things out. Like they were dominating. I think they had a plus 18 net rating the last couple of months they played together, and they had really clicked in a way that the offense was humming. I mean, we saw that March stretch, like the best defenses in the league up until they faced OKC could do nothing against their offense. They're still an open-ended, like, can they work together defensively? And I really have been looking at the Knicks as the blueprint for the Lakers, because the Knicks have four players next year going to be making $33 or more million. So that build can work to some degree. Like you've got Kat, Mikal Bridges, Jalen Brunson, OG Anunoby. They're all making $33 or more million. So if the Lakers had three guys making $33 or more million, like that still fits within the salary cap. And obviously New York has been building this, and they've done most of their work via trade rather than free agency, though they did sign Brunson in free agency. Like the Knicks, they've worked together with having a bunch of big contracts and finding ways to supplement that with depth. They also have two somewhat flawed defenders in Kat and Jalen Brunson. Like Kat's been awesome in the playoffs. He's had a solid defensive year overall, but he's not this defensive anchor, traditional rim protector. He's not Wemby. He's not Rudy Gobert. There are some limitations with having Kat as your last line of defense, but they have supplemented them with the Harts and OGs and Mikal Bridges and the Jose Alvarados and Deuce McBrides and Mitchell Robinson. So it's like, that's where I think to the point of, can Luka and LeBron coexist? They can, but I think you have to nail the rest of the top eight or nine, and it has to be all guys that are above average defensively. And that's where we then run into where I keep just going to like, okay, if you're keeping LeBron, I think it does start to get a little tricky keeping guys like Rui and Luke Kennard, because those guys don't check that defensive box. Yeah. And they do check the shooting, which is important. But it's like, I think at that point, if you are saying the big three are our core, everybody else has to be an above average defender. And anyone who doesn't fit that, I don't know that you can keep them on the roster.
Yeah, agreed. And it's something where you may, it ultimately comes down to what is going to get the net best result from the team. You may take a little step back in one area, but a big step forward in others. So like if you lose Rui, of course, you're going to take a step back shooting the ball, and nobody wants to see that. And there's going to be frustration. You're going to be hearing every time the Lakers have a bad shooting night, you'd be hearing, oh man, if they still had Rui, this wouldn't have happened, right? But can you take such a step forward defensively that it more than makes up for that? Kind of like when we saw midseason, right? This, a lot of people took it as offensive that LeBron James was suddenly becoming the third guy. It wasn't really about that. It wasn't like LeBron has the ball too much and that's a problem, you know, because LeBron's not efficient. LeBron is great. It was about getting the best out of all three of them together. And if that meant taking a step back in one category, but that was going to get much bigger benefits in others, your net can be a big, big positive. And so that's what the Lakers have got to figure out. Like if they do take a step back in shooting because they lose Kennard, because they lose Rui, but they take a big step up in rebounding and athleticism and perimeter defense and transition defense and all these other areas, that can more than make up for that. So it's a matter of figuring out what exactly they can do to really juice the numbers and get themselves to be the best total team they can be, even if it does mean understanding that, hey, we have to lose some in a few categories here to bump up a few other things. All right, I do want to get into our chat questions. We got a lot coming in here. Want to spend some time on that in the second half of the show. But first, let's give a shout out to our sponsor, and that is Prize Picks. I don't know if you guys are aware, but the World Cup is kicking off like in minutes, which is awesome. Always an incredible event every 4 years. Love the World Cup. And right now, the over at Prize Picks, they've got a great promo. Cesar Montes, 0.5 passes attempted. Yeah, I think he's going to clear that. That's a freebie right there. If you guys want to get in on that, go head over to Prize Picks. Use the link in the description down below. Play $5, get $50 instantly. The code is HMA. We appreciate Prize Picks for sponsoring the show. Go check them out. Again, link is in the description. If you're going to play, please do so responsibly. Okay, let's dedicate the last part of the show here to the chat. And we'll start with this super chat question. It said, can we get Scotty Barnes with the assets we have? He would have to be a all of your picks type guy. And even then, I don't know that that's enough to get Toronto to move on from him.
I don't think so.
Yeah. I think he's aiming a bit.
What would be the goal? If I'm Toronto, I'm trying to, I mean, they had a solid season. I think they were better than some people, including myself, thought they were going to be, but I would be trying to build around Scotty Barnes and like take the next step in the next year or two rather than give him up. So if I'm giving up my franchise guy who I think was easily a top 20 player this season, I'm not just doing that for, I think our perception of what's attainable has sort of been warped with some of these recent trades with like the Desmond Bane, Mikhail Bridges, but it's like, yeah, a guy of Scotty Barnes caliber, I don't think you even get for three picks right now. Like it just wouldn't really make sense for Toronto.
I would slot Scotty Barnes easily ahead of Trey Murphy. And I don't think you even necessarily get Trey Murphy with that number of picks. So in terms, yeah, of what's realistic for the Lakers to actually target, we're probably, if we're looking at wings, if Derrick Jones Jr. was not a Clipper, we'd be talking a bit more about him. Obviously that's a challenge with him being a Clipper, but like the Lakers are going to be more, their price range is going to be more like the Herb Joneses of the world than the Scotty Barnes. I would love to see it, but that's going to be tough to get up there.
I mean, he'd be an amazing fit. He'd be an amazing fit next to Luka, but yeah.
All right, let's go here. Austin Reeves' team wants the max. LeBron wants the max. Rob wants to run it back with the same team. I hope Luka wants out of L.A. Cuban wasted a few years of his career, and now L.A. You know what? We could. I think the big thing that I want to get to here is this time of year, it's very easy for stuff that's maybe written or presented as a hypothetical situation to turn into what's being taken as fact. And I think sometimes people run a little crazy with some of the rumors that are out there and just, you know, like jumping to, well, Austin's team wants the max. Well, yeah, in a negotiation, you're probably going to start high. LeBron wants the max. Is that all set in stone to the point where we should jump to, oh, they clearly are hell-bent on a path to destruction and they are just going to run the same team back and Luka needs to get out of here and all of that. Pump the brakes on all of this stuff and let's see what actually happens before we just assume that this is locked in, written in stone as the plan here.
I totally agree. I think it's natural for Austin to want the max. It's natural for LeBron to want the max. But you have to look at, like, they can want it. It's another thing entirely whether they're going to get it. And you also have to look at what their alternatives are, right? So Austin can want the max, but if the Lakers are not going to give him the max, he could go get the max from another team, but he's probably going to a situation in like Chicago or Brooklyn where he's now in a rebuilding situation, probably not even a play-in team. And he might be getting his 40-year 178, but like he's now in a situation where he's not competing, right? And not as relevant as he is being on, you know, playing for the Lakers, being on a team with contending aspirations. For LeBron, if it's max or bust in LA, well, then he's going to be playing for the minimum or playing for the non-taxpayer MLE, unless he wants to go to Chicago or Brooklyn and take their cap space. And that really wouldn't make sense. Then with Rob, that would, I will say there's been some buzz lately about the Lakers potentially running it back. And like, that's been the one thing that, like, the Lakers have tended to run it back. So if you're just throwing a shot in the dark, betting on the Lakers to run it back has been a safe bet these last few years. Mm-hmm. But there has been, like, there'll be the cycle of, oh, the Lakers are interested in this, the Lakers are interested in this. A lot of times it does not pan out. Then it ends up kind of going to, well, they're probably just going to run it back, do something small. That has been the safe bet the last few years. That has often been, aside from the Luka Doncic trade, like the way that they've operated. So, I mean, there has been some of that out there. I'm not going to deny that, but I don't think they could do it. If they do it, then they'll have to answer to that, because I would hope that the fan base would be pretty upset at that point and more upset than they've even been the last few years.
I just don't see how you can trumpet optionality for years and then get to the point where you've got that optionality you've been talking about and say, eh, let's just keep it all the same. I just can't see that being the ultimate outcome here. Now, then again, I couldn't see them sitting on their hands all summer and only drafting Dalton Connect and signing Bronny James, and they did that a few years ago. You never know, for sure. But I would be surprised if the end result is they just run back the same roster, particularly with the situation Luka is in contractually. I think there's got to be a lot of motivation to get things done. And I've been saying it for over a year. You got to get it done now. You got to go into the season with a team that is ready to roll this summer and not say, hey, we'll see what we can do with the trade deadline once again. MJ said, get well soon to the Spurs fans and especially Fox. Blunder is going down in infamy if they do lose. So ready for the Lakers offseason to start as soon as the finals end. Please, Rob, don't F this up. You know, I'm trying, Jovan, when finals games are on, to just take in and appreciate the basketball that we're seeing. Because as fun as Summer League is, it's not even the same sport sometimes when you're watching a Summer League game compared to what we're seeing right now in the NBA Finals. I'm trying to enjoy it, but I kind of have the same feeling too, where I'm like, this is awesome, this series is great, but I know the offseason really gets to start when the finals come to an end. So I'm very excited for what the summer can bring as well. And we know that can't happen really until the finals ultimately. And it could be that the first big domino in terms of a Giannis trade, that could be on hold while we're waiting for the finals to end as well. So it wouldn't shock me if the finals end, the dam bursts, and then we get a bunch of other things happening around the league as we get closer and closer to the draft. So it's like, I'm trying to live in the moment and enjoy this, but at the same time, I can't help but be excited about what's to come here.
I've had a different version of that where I'm more so looking at the finals, and I think I'd add OKC in, because I think right now OKC, San Antonio, and New York are the three best teams in the NBA in some order. Just like the level of defense those three teams are playing. Like they each have their flaws, some in terms of basketball IQ, sure. Some in terms of shot making, some, like, you know, whatever the flaws are. But I think most of their flaws are on the offensive end. Defensively, all three of those teams are lights out. And I think for the Lakers, like, you can't replicate the OKC or San Antonio builds through the draft. even the New York situation, they were able to make some pretty big trades that the Lakers can maybe pull off one of those types of trades, but it's going to be hard to have like a quartet on the same level as New York's quartet. I just think the thing that they need to be striving toward is like, how do we get to that level defensively? Because I think the last team standing, they've had their star power, they've had their offensive fireworks, but they've also had an incredibly high, like they've been top five level defenses. So how did the Lakers get to that? Because the current group is not close to that. And that's the thing that they got to, I think, try to strive for this summer.
Is it possible to get a team built around Luka, Austin, and LeBron?
I don't know if it's possible with the big three. And that might be its own topic for future show here before the offseason. But I don't think it's possible. I don't think you could have a top five defense with those three guys being three of the five. So that is where those who want to see the Lakers break up the core and go in a different direction, like that to me is the strongest argument for it.
All right. For each of the RFAs, we will target Watson, Ellis, Ochai, Kessler. What is the max you would offer them? Understanding we may need to overpay.
I like Ellis and Ochai getting thrown in here.
Yeah, right. Right. I mean, like, would you go? So, like, Walker Kessler has a full max of it's the 25% max, the 41.5. Would you go to that level to get Walker Kessler, who I think is at the top of both of our lists for who the Lakers target at the center spot? Would you go all the way to the 25% max to get him?
No. I think I'd go metaphorical gun to my head here. I would pay Kessler maybe 33 max. I would go 30-ish. Once you get to that point, it's like if it's a million, you know, if I say 33 and then it would cost 34, like I'd probably go to 34. But in general, I would say low 30s for Kessler, 30-ish for Watson. Durin's the tricky one because I probably don't go above mid 30s for Durin. I would not sniff the full max and pay him 40 plus. I would say 35-ish for Durin, and then Eason, I would go as high as like 20-ish, but with all these, I'm acknowledging they are overpays. They are more than I think the player is worth, but I am willing to go somewhere between 3 to 5 million over because I think the Lakers acquiring a long-term piece, even if you have to overpay slightly, like ideally the player grows into, like you're overpaying on their current value or their current projection, but ideally the player takes another step and grows into that contract. And I don't think it's overpaying. It's one thing to over, like I think Kessler 41 would be a gross overpay where you're overpaying 10 to 12 million. That's a really tough contract to move. If Kessler's worth 28 and you pay him 31, 32, I don't think that's enough of an overpay to like tank the value of that contract, for example. So Ellis and Ochai, I think Ellis is probably going to be a single digit million guy. Like I think his value has tanked since going to Cleveland. I mean, he was getting DNP CDs there during the Knicks series.
I don't think he even goes back to the Cavs.
He might be
a
minimum guy.
They probably pick Dean Wade over Keon Ellis.
Yeah. But Ellis and Ochai to me are two guys that you could probably get sub 10 million that I'd be interested in. And I mean, either one of them as a minimum, that's a no brainer. But even if it's a $5 million deal, $6 million deal, you use part of the room exception on them, I would be open to that. But those guys I wouldn't go crazy with, but I think there's four clear RFAs. The one guy I'm out on personally that I just don't think would fit what the Lakers need is Benedict Mathurin. I think he's a little bit too much of a gunner that and not as good enough defensively as they need. So that's the guy that at a certain price I'd be interested, but probably not the price he's going to go for.
God, that would just be like an all-time free throw shooting team volume-wise. If you put Ben Mathurin with Luka and Austin, it would get all the free throws. So when I look at restricted free agents, I think one of the things that we have to remember is that you probably are going to have to overpay to get them away from their incumbent teams. We also have to remember that if it's June 30th and we're 2 hours into free agency, and everybody's saying, why didn't they offer Walker Kessler yet? Remember, these deals can't be signed until June 6th. That's when the moratorium ends. Then they've got 24 hours to match, which is, I'm sorry, July 6th. Then they can't be matched till July 7th, or they've got until July 7th to match that. So that's a long time to have your cap space tied up if you verbally agree with like a Walker Kessler, Peyton Watson, any of those guys. I like what you said, though, about that you want to, if you're going to overpay somebody, you at least want it to be reasonable to think that there's a shot that even if it's an overpay right now, it will not be in the future. Which of these guys do you think, if you overpaid them a reasonable amount, let's say $5 million or less, more than what their actual value should be, but enough to get them away from their team, which of these guys would you be most confident will outperform that and ultimately take what looks like a maybe overpay contract now, ultimately turn it into a contract that we see as a positive value?
Probably Peyton Watson, just because I think if you look at that archetype of the Jaden McDaniels, I mean, he's got some Bridges and some Ananobi in his game as well. But I think the goal with it, like, I don't think he's as good defensively as Jaden McDaniels, but I think his offensive ceiling might actually end up being slightly higher than Jaden McDaniels. But like that general archetype of, could he be your long rangey point of attack guy? I think he guards down really well, but he really improved as a shooter this year, as a self-creator ISO guy, and he's a transition threat. I think you could use him on and off the ball. So I think Watson, just based on his offensive upside, is the guy that, I mean, that's typically the pathway to overperforming a contract. Kessler would be my second choice, just because I think he's flown under the radar because he plays in Utah. They have these like nice starts to the season, then they start tanking and resting guys. He had the shoulder injury last year. So he's a guy who I feel like people know who he is, but I don't think they realize how good he actually is. And getting some, you know, shining some light on him in LA would show people like, this is a dude who, there's a reason why people have compared him to Rudy Gobert so frequently throughout his career. Yeah. And you know, Gobert's been a guy who's been in that 35, 40 million range. But I think with centers, it's a little trickier. An injury or something could easily wipe out the value of a center. With Watson, I think he's the one that I look at, that if you get the best version of Watson and he continues to ascend, he could easily outkick that contract.
Where do you put, because Tari Eason wasn't brought up here, but obviously he's one of the other big RFAs.
I mentioned Tari Eason as a $20 million guy, right, for me. I like him. I think that the shooting concerns me, where first half of the season, he was a 41, 42% three-point shooter. Second half of the season, 28%. So he had this like tale of two seasons. But I think he does have some of the IQ stuff, where just some of the plays he made in that Lakers series were head scratchers. But overall, I would say he does fit that. Like, when his three-point shot is falling, and I think he'd be getting shot quality, like incredible shot quality playing next to Luka, Austin, and LeBron. The defense, the toughness, the rebounding, the athleticism, and the shooting when his shot is falling, like, he does check a lot of those boxes. So I think I'm probably higher on Eason than most, I would say.
He's a really interesting one, because like you said, he does check a lot of boxes, but that was insane. The way his season went was so split in half. He was amazing shooting the ball the first half of the season and then couldn't hit anything at all the second. I mean, they were reaching out to Lethal Shooter and stuff, trying to figure out how to help this guy. That was absolutely bonkers. Let's see. Technically, the series is still not over yet. The Spurs have still got a chance, but there's Windhorse went after Luka. Why not keep in the same bar for Wemby? Wemby, the turn is coming for Wemby. Right now, he's still the shiny new toy. Right now, he is still the darling and all of that. And make no mistake, Wemby is incredible. It's possible that he's going to do just absolute game-breaking stuff on a nightly basis. I think that this, if the Spurs go on to lose these finals, this could be the best step for Wemby's development yet, the best setback that he's ever had, because I think this will propel him forward. Wemby's going to be very, very, very good. Right now, a lot of accolades are being heaped upon him. He's not getting picked apart for some of his flaws the way that he will a few years from now if he doesn't improve from where he's at right now. There is something to the, like I said, the shiny new toy effect that we're seeing right now with Victor Wembanyama. That's coming. This is pretty normal when we get a guy who's the fun new player. We see it with teams too. They're the fun new up-and-coming team. Just wait. You either die the hero or you live long enough to become the villain. OKC is going through that right now, right? For a while, they were the fun up-and-coming team. Now everybody hates them. It takes time, but over time, you beat enough teams, you do enough things, you say enough things that for people to get upset about, and the criticism will start coming. That's going to happen for Wemby, just like it will happen for any other player. That's coming.
I agree. I also think for some unknown reason that, you know, we've tried to break it down, but I don't know if there's like a technical answer for it. Like, Luka has just not fully been embraced by the media to the level that I think a guy like Jokic or Wemby have, or I wouldn't say Shea, because I think Shea has gotten it pretty bad, and you had the whole operation game with Shea and stuff. So I think Shea has been, you know, under the microscope as well. But yeah, it's just interesting that I do think the media has their darlings or their players that they will overlook certain things with for a variety of reasons. I don't know if it's personality. I don't know if it's like, I think, yeah, I don't even know. Like, I could speculate. Jersey, I could try to come up with reasons, but it just, yeah, it's kind of been, yeah.
I mean, we've seen the voting. There's a there's a history of the media taking Lakers players and maybe knocking that up. Maybe it's East Coast bias. Maybe,
but I think it was before LA. I think it was before LA that Luka, I mean, the Windhorst thing was from the finals. So
that's true. Luka is,
I think what, once you get lit, like I've compared Luka and Kobe to a degree, and I think there are some similarities in terms of how they get covered or how they get overlooked. And I think there's this like general thing where once you get labeled a ball dominant, heliocentric chucker, because I do think those types of guys, like if you think about some of the guys who've gotten it the worst in the media the last 2 years, it's been Luka, it's been Trae Young, it's been James Harden. And to be clear, Luka's in a different class. Like, you know, prime James Harden's a different story, but like, you know, recent James Harden, Trae Young, some of their playoff struggles, whatever. But like, I think once you get labeled a ball dominant, shot chucking, heliocentric player, that label is hard to shake. And it you know, because Jokic does not get, I mean, Jokic does not play like that, but Jokic doesn't have that label. Wemby does not have that label on him. And I feel like that's like the one basketball label that once you get assigned it, it is hard to shake that. And it feels like it colors the way that you are viewed in like a negative light, where everything is just like, because I mean, Luka's gotten it for defense or conditioning, whatever, but it's also, I think, been this element of like, I think some people just don't like when I talk to people about what they don't like about Luka, some people just don't like his game and they think he takes too many shots. And I think that is something that once you get ascribed that, like, that to me is like, that's the only thing I could think of, because I do think there's a trend where certain players get called ball dominant, ball hogs, shot chuckers, whatever. And once you have that, and I think it even sums back to like Kobe had that reputation. And for some people, he just was not their cup of tea in terms of his style of play. And so that's the only thing I could think of. Otherwise, yeah. Cause I mean, I think people even put like, he's international. Well, Jokic is beloved and he's international. Wemby's beloved and he's international. So I don't think that is the only thing within this. So I don't know what it is, but yeah, I mean, he's definitely had a different standard, I would say, than a lot of other stars.
I think you find confirmation. If you do see him as that shot chucker, you're going to see moments where you're going to go, oh, that's not a good shot. Right. And so you're going to be able to pinpoint that. Thing is, for Luka, what is a bad shot for 99% of the league is not a bad shot for Luka, because he can make it at a high enough percentage. There were portions of the season when we talked about maybe dialing back the three-point attempts, especially the step backs, but he did get that dialed in as the season went on. But I do think if you're of that mindset, if you make up your mind, Luka, chucker, ball hog, all that kind of stuff, you're going to watch Luka play and you're going to go, see, chucker, ball hog, see, right there, right? You're going to see moments where he does stuff where that you're going to get that confirmation that that's what he is. And it's easier to dismiss the other things that he's doing. It's easier to dismiss the efficiency, the other stuff. When he makes a good rotation and he cuts off a baseline drive, that's not necessarily something that results in a turnover. That's not necessarily something that pops, that's going to dispel the defensive narratives, where if he gets a beat off the dribble, that maybe it happens once in a game, but that's it. You saw it. It stood out. It pops off the screen and you go, yep, see, turnstile on defense. He's a cone, right? That's the kind of problem I think that Luka's gotten. You're right. It is very, very difficult to get away from that kind of label once it's on you. But it's also true with, we get to a point as well with like LeBron, right? Late in a game, LeBron James, if he takes the shot, he's a ball hog. If he passes it, he's scared of the moment, right? There's certain guys, you get to a point with fans where there's no winning. And that's just the unfortunate reality of being a basketball superstar. But I do agree that Luka gets it a little worse than most. I think ultimately it is coming for Wemby as well. It seems Luka's flaws are less forgivable. I also think, just to put a bow on this, the constant complaining to the officials does not help his case with this. If you're somebody who is already kind of on the fence about Luka, that can be very off-putting, the way he'll talk to officials. And once he picked up, I thought the best thing that happened for Luka's game last season, or one of them, was him getting a 14th technical, because he was on his best behavior after that, and he was doing a much better job like getting back defensively and everything. He became, I think, to the neutral fan, a more likable player after he picked up a 14th technical. So I think the constant chirping to the officials doesn't help his case either.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of stuff with it. I just think I can now say, like, having covered Luka for the last year and a half, like, I do see the double standard to a degree. And to be clear, like, he has his flaws. I'm not saying sure. He's a perfect player. There are certainly things that I have been critical of and complained about and think he needs to shore up, including that, like, he should not be getting suspended for technicals. Like, that is inexcusable. That is something that is within his control. So there's definitely things that he can be better with, but I just think in general, as someone who's been in the media now for 15 years, like, I can say that I see people pick and choose what they want to focus on, what they want to highlight in terms of flaws or weaknesses. And everyone has them to some degree. Some are louder than others, but I think he's gotten covered through a very critical lens, especially the last couple of years.
Yep. Agreed. Love from Sweden. Welcome in from Sweden. Happy to have you here. Keep up the good work. When do you guys think the Lakers will announce the signing of the other assistant GM?
It's a great question.
Yeah.
I mean, they've been going through the interview process. They have gotten close-ish with several candidates that have been out there, but we've seen some people get promotions out of being up for being a Lakers assistant GM. I think it'll be soon here. Like, I would expect it before free agency starts. I think, like, you need that going into free agency. You should, I mean, ideally this was something that they had immediately after the season ended and they were going through that process during the season. But I would say before free agency starts, but I don't have an exact date as of right now.
So in other words, you're trying to negotiate before you accept the offer, is what you're saying.
You know, I'm available for business here. I'll come at a cheaper cost probably than some of these other candidates.
All right, let's go here. Should the Lakers go get the Hawks pick that's open to trade and still keep the 25th pick? So get a wing and young center too. I thought about that. That was in Jake Fisher's report today. Stuck it in right at the end that, like, the Hawks don't want to make two first-round picks. They want to move their 23rd pick and get something for it. Based on what I said earlier, yeah, I wouldn't be picking up an extra draft pick when I'm talking about why they should trade the 25th pick, unless it's a scenario where you're going to be able to use that pick to go somewhere else and use that as capital to go. Like, let's say there's a team that says, you know, we're going to trade you whatever, I don't know, Herb Jones or Trey Burton, whoever it is, whatever, insert player name right here. But we really want two picks in this draft. The Lakers could say, okay, well, instead of giving you our 2032 pick or whatever it is, we're going to give you, we'll make this swap with the Hawks and then we'll give you the 23rd pick in the draft instead. There could be a team in that scenario. That's the thing that I could envision where it would make sense to the Lakers to get into the mix. I don't think they should be going out there and trying to get another pick, because I don't think the Hawks are just giving it away. They're going to want something for it. And I don't think the Lakers should be in the business right now of loading up on young players. You need guys that you know can step in and contribute right now.
I agree.
All right, we'll do a couple more here. What would Luka do if the roster is disappointing? I mean, 2028, he could take a look around and see what other options are out there. San Antonio has the talent, but New York seems to have a toughness that's hard to quantify. Even if the Lakers acquire the right talent, would this team have the chemistry and the mentality to win at all? Part of that is an unknown, Jovan. I mean, part of that, you don't know until you get the guys on the floor. And that's one of the things that, to me, was inescapable about the 2019-2020 team. From day one media day, there was just a vibe. Like, you could sense that those guys were on the same page. There was a effortlessness to the way they all fit together, And that is a fairly rare thing. But again, that's not something that you necessarily know. Like you can't scheme that. You know, you could plan to have certain personalities and stuff on your team, but there's a degree of we have to get all these guys in the same place on the floor together before you can know what your chemistry is going to really be like.
And I will add here that I thought this group actually had a lot of chemistry and toughness, and think about how many comebacks they had during the regular season. Think about the resolve they showed in the wake of the Luka and Austin injuries and the way that they closed the regular season, the way that they won that first round series against Houston and the comeback that they had in game three, the way that they snatched Houston's soul early in game six. I think this group had some, like on paper, you do not put them up against a lot of these other teams and say, oh, like it's a more finesse group, I would say on paper, but I thought they showed, and I also give JJ and the coaching staff a lot of credit for the culture that they've built here over the last couple of years, because I mean, that group even last year, like had a really disappointing first round loss to Minnesota, but the way that they closed that series, the season, that 20-4 stretch, best defense in the league, like there is a level of resolve and toughness and tenacity with the group. I think really to me, it's actually been largely a talent thing where they have been throwing out these lineups and rotations where you have like one or two consistently above average defenders in the lineup. And that's just a tough thing to navigate in the modern NBA. Like you just compare their defensive talent to OKC, San Antonio's, New York's, like it's not even close. Those teams have far more defensive depth and talent on their roster. So the Lakers need to go get some of those horses this summer.
Yep. And we'll see if they're able to do it. Of course, we'll be right here at the Lakers Collective covering all of it. We appreciate everybody for joining us today. Super chats that we didn't get to. I know we had quite a few. I have saved them. Get to those at least over the weekend to make sure that we get those in. We do appreciate all of you joining. Jovan, we didn't have Jason today. He wasn't available. But I thought we had a good conversation. And this was a lot of fun.
This was. We'll be back Monday or Tuesday. I guess we haven't decided that yet. But yeah. We'll be back early next week, 11 a.m. Pacific time per usual. And yeah, look forward to seeing how the rest of the finals play out. I guess game five is Saturday. So we'll have a likely a game five reaction to some degree on early
will
next week.
Will the NBA season be over the next show we have?
I think it goes six and New York wins in six, but it's possible they win in five. Like the Spurs, we'll learn a lot about the Spurs in that game five. Because even if they have the lead, no matter what now, like they could be up by 30 and you have no confidence that they're going to actually hold the lead.
Very true. Very true. As we saw, 29-point lead, gone. And they wind up losing. All right, everybody. If you haven't done so yet, hit the subscribe button over on the Lakers Collective YouTube channel. If you're following over on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you listen to podcasts, please give us that 5-star rating and review. Go enjoy some World Cup soccer, everybody. Till next time. See ya and stay safe.